Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In this series, we take a close look at important people and events in history that have been either ignored or presented in an inaccurate or misleading way. Today, we're going to focus not on a particular historical figure or event, but rather on the large question of how history, American history in particular, is taught to our young students in high school. Are American students getting the true story about their own history? To answer this question, we're pleased to have as our guest today Professor James Loewen, a scholar who spent 2 years evaluating 12 leading high school textbooks on American history. We'll hear Professor Loewen's report card on these textbooks right after this short break. Welcome back to History Counts. This is Ken McDermott Rowe. My guest today is Professor James Loewen, and we're going to talk about his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong. Jim Loewen received a Ph.D. in sociology from Harvard. He taught race relations for 20 years at the University of Vermont, and previously he taught at predominantly black Tougaloo College in Mississippi. Jim Loewen's other books include Mississippi, Conflict and Change, Sundown Towns, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. He's currently working on Surprises on the Landscape, Unexpected Places That Get History Right. Lies My Teacher Told Me received the American Book Award in 1996. It was recently republished by Touchstone, and it sold over 800,000 copies. Thanks for joining us, Professor Loewen.
It'll be my pleasure, I'm sure.
Jim, could you talk to us about the methodology involved in reviewing the textbooks that constituted the basis for your book?
Yes. I got into this project because of some because of an aha experience I had in Mississippi, or I may better call it an oh no experience. I was teaching at Tougaloo College, as you mentioned. That's a historically black and overwhelmingly black school. And my first year teaching there, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I was also teaching one section of what was called the Freshman Social Science Seminar. Now, this was a course set up by the history department to introduce students to all of the social sciences, and it did so in the context of African-American history, which made sense, being as 99% of our students were African-American. Now, that's the same chronology as American history, of course, and in that chronology, second semester begins right after Reconstruction, with the period known as, right after the Civil War, with the period known as Reconstruction. So I had a new group of students that second semester, and I didn't want to do all the talking that first day of class, so I asked them, okay, what's Reconstruction? What happened then? And 16 out of 17 of them said to me, well, that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. Oh, no. I mean, there's three, at least three, maybe four direct lies in that sentence. Blacks never took over the government of the southern states. The southern states had white governors throughout Reconstruction. All but one had white legislative majorities, and so on. I won't even go into the rest of them, but it convinced me that the history they had learned in high school, and I went off, and this is the beginning of my methodology, I went off to nearby high schools and watched history being taught and examined the books being used, particularly in Mississippi, in the course Mississippi History, which was required in fifth grade and again in ninth grade. Well, I did various things about that in Mississippi, but we'll cut to the American history question. When I moved after 8 years to the University of Vermont, my UVM students, as it's called, first-year students again, I like teaching first-year students, convinced me that misknowing American history was not a Mississippi phenomenon. It was a national phenomenon. Mississippi represented it in a more exaggerated form, as Mississippi represented a lot of problems back then in a more exaggerated form, but they were national problems. So I did the same thing in Vermont. Now, I have to say most of my students, over 50%, 60% maybe, came from out of state. A bunch of them came from Connecticut, for the record. But I went to nearby schools, nearby to Burlington, Vermont high schools, and again, I watched history being taught, and I gathered 12 of the most popular American history textbooks then in use. And I then studied them carefully after watching teachers teach straight from the book. And I later found some research that shows not anecdotally, but with data, that American history is taught more from the book, and the textbook is used more minutes of the hour in class than any other subject, which I think is astounding.
In your book, you said, as a result of your analysis of these 12 American history textbooks, you said the books actually make students stupid.
Yeah, they do. Shall I give you an example?
Sure.
I invented this Vietnam exercise. Let's just put it this way. In many areas, and in the case I'm talking about, questions about the Vietnam War, the more education people have, the stupider they are. That is, the worse they answer the question, the more counterfactually. And so I'm just going to let it hang there, except I'll say this. In no other field is this true. I mean, if you look at people who take a math quiz, and let's say they're adults, it doesn't make any difference, but let's say they're adults, the more math they had in high school, the better they do on the math quiz. The same is even true in American literature, but it's not true in American history. The more history they've had and the more education they've had, the less likely they are to get lots of questions right on an American history test.
You demonstrate that some of the people that we're very familiar with are actually presented in a very inaccurate way in our books. And you talk about, for example, Helen Keller. And you say that, quote, Helen Keller, who struggled so valiantly to learn to speak, has been made mute by history. Could you talk about her?
Yeah, she did struggle, didn't she? I mean, here she was, became blind and deaf in early childhood. And she actually learned to speak, not well, but well enough to be understood. And she learned to write. And what did she use that writing for? Well, our education is usually silent about what she wrote. Books, I'll say, or she became a humanitarian. I mean, as I sometimes say to students in class, could you be more vague?
But at Radcliffe, she became very political, right?
She became very political and very left-wing. She became a socialist, and when that wasn't far enough left for her, she became a Wobbly, a member of the International Workers of the World, the socialist union that Woodrow Wilson persecuted, of course. When the Soviet Union occurred shortly thereafter, she flew a red flag in her study and wrote some embarrassing stuff. Let us follow the rising star in the east. Onward, comrades, onward to the rising star.
She saw that her blindness was also related to economic status.
Yeah,
people becoming blind.
The two are tied together, and we can maybe make fun of her today for being so left-wing. But the point is that there was something to it. She became aware that blindness is not distributed equally across the social strata, but it's concentrated in the lower class because of industrial accidents, because of bad medical care for some women, because of syphilitic blindness if they're prostitutes, and so on. And so she realized that if you're just going to treat blindness by doing things like improving the Braille alphabet and helping the treatment of the blind, you are treating effect, but you're ignoring cause.
So
that's why she went so far left.
So why do the history books leave out the last 64 years of her life?
Well, I think they do this because they think it's bad. I mean, I think they do this as a favor to Helen Keller, and of course it's just the opposite. Helen Keller would be outraged at how she's portrayed. They also leave out all kinds of other bad things. I treat Helen Keller in a chapter with Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, please talk about him, because as I read the book, I realized that Woodrow Wilson that was presented to me in high school textbooks wasn't the real Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, he's a great star as he's presented, because they leave out the two terrible things he did in office. And, of course, he was in office for 8 important years. First, he was an astounding foreign interventionist. At my website, and folks can go to my website, the best way to find it is just to type my name, James W. Lowen, L-O-E-W-E-N, into a search engine with quotation marks around it. My website will come up right up at the top. And you can take a quiz there, and it's a hilarious quiz. It's the most fun quiz you'll ever fail, but you will fail it. And one of the questions has to do with Woodrow Wilson. And it lists about 6 or 8 countries, and it says, which one of these countries did Woodrow Wilson not invade? And it turns out he invaded 7 of them, and some of the ones he invaded Mexico a total of 13 different times during his administration. He invaded many Caribbean and Latin American countries, and then he topped it off by invading the Soviet Union. And he did this really secretly. I mean, regardless of what we may think about the propriety of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, and I talk about that later in the book, at least he did bring it to Congress, and Congress did sign off on it. But Woodrow Wilson not only didn't bring his invasion of the Soviet Union to Congress, he tried to hide it from Congress.
And, of course, he also had this anti-civil liberties program.
And the second, yes, he had anti-civil liberties and even worse against civil rights. His racism was astounding. I think he's the most racist president in the history of the country after the end of slavery, that is, after Buchanan's administration.
You mentioned he segregated the civil service.
He segregated the civil service. He segregated the Navy. What this meant was black folks were mostly fired. They no longer could be, for instance, postal carriers in many places. They couldn't be mail sorters, or if they were, they were behind a screen or in a separate room. He kept them out of many jobs that they had kind of routinely gotten as patronage jobs under the Republicans, like Register of the Treasury, which is a rather high job, and port collector in New Orleans. But he did worse than that. He told nigger jokes in cabinet meetings. He loved the movie Birth of a Nation, which is a seriously racist movie, but also a wonderful cinematic advance for its time. It's the first great movie epic. And this helps, both this and Wilson's kind of racism from the top, helped cause the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, now you see, he after his term ended, he was actually very unpopular in the 1920s, but then was sort of resurrected.
Don't realize that when he left office, he was massively unpopular. I mean, Warren Harding won what is still the largest landslide to this day. If you look at the proportion of the vote he got compared to the proportion of the vote Wilson got, Harding wins the prize.
1920, yeah.
Yeah, and Harding is hardly a sterling president or a sterling candidate. So this was really a repudiation of Wilson, and for good reason. Because he had another thing that, and here he is a successful president in terms of the war. So it's really quite amazing that his Democratic successor does so poorly in 1920. But it's not so amazing when you realize that he was such a bad president in these three ways: civil rights, civil liberties, and invading all kinds of other countries.
But after World War II, he's kind of held up as a great hero.
How we see history is colored so much by who we are and what the times we live in. And now, in the 1940s and 50s, and for that matter, the 60s and into the 2000s or whatever we're in, the notion that we have not only the right, but the obligation and ought to be in invading all kinds of other countries is commonplace.
Well, he represents what you call the process of heroification. Somehow we need heroes, so our leaders have to be put on a pedestal.
Yeah, and that's the same thing that happened with Helen Keller. I mean, almost everybody who's treated in American history textbooks is converted into a hero. There's one main exception, and that would be John Brown. But almost everybody else, regardless of what they did, is converted into a hero. Franklin W. Pierce is my favorite example. He's my candidate for the second worst president of all time. He was so bad that when he came back to New Hampshire, from which he's the only president ever elected, there wasn't even somebody to meet him. They thought he was terrible. But do any textbooks say anything like that about Franklin W. Pierce? They don't want to say anything bad because they might offend somebody. I mean, there's now a Franklin W. Pierce College in New Hampshire, so they've kind of forgotten that he was terrible and now claim him as the only president from New Hampshire. So you wouldn't want to not get your book adopted because you offended somebody in New Hampshire. So let's not say anything bad about Franklin W. Let's not say anything bad about Woodrow Wilson. Let's not say anything bad about anybody.
An important phase of American history that you talk about in your book has to do with the Native Americans. And you write, quote, "Apart from the European invasion itself, the pestilence is surely the most important event in the history of America." Could you talk about disease and the Native Americans?
The number one thing that the Pilgrims were thankful for was this huge pestilence that had struck the natives of New Hampshire. Excuse me. It did strike New Hampshire, but I've got New Hampshire on the brain. Massachusetts, just before they set foot, it struck it maybe in 1617 or 18. And native people were swept by plague after plague. Now, I have to say, and these plagues account for the following fact. If you look around the world in 1892, say, white folks dominate almost every country. The two big exceptions would be maybe Ethiopia and Japan. But they dominate China. They dominate India, of course. They dominate all of Africa. They dominate the Americas, Australia, and so on. But if you look around in 1992, 100 years later, China is now run by Chinese. India is run by Indians. Africa is run by Africans. I mean, you can make arguments about neocolonialism, but they're running the government, at least formally. Not so in the Americas, and not so, for that matter, in Hawaii and Australia and New Zealand. Why? Well, because these areas, having been detached from Eurasia, the people there were remarkably healthy. They didn't have livestock in the main, and they didn't have, therefore, the diseases that keep getting passed back and forth between people and the animals that they keep. And as a result, when the Europeans and Africans did arrive on the Western Hemisphere shores, they rapidly communicated diseases to the native inhabitants that almost wiped them out. Now that's, I really am serious, that's the most important, or one of the two most important geopolitical occurrences in the last millennium.
You say it may have been as many as 98% of the Native Americans that died.
Yeah, certainly 90 to 95% of the whole hemisphere. I mean, if you look at the population estimates, well, for instance, Columbus sets foot on Haiti in 1493. Well, he sets foot on it in 1492, but he comes back to take it, to occupy it in 1493. And at that point, my estimate for the population of Haiti would be 3 million. Some people estimate as high as 8 million, but I think 3 million is probably about right. Well, by 1560, which is just 65 years after Columbus arrives, the native population of Haiti is zero. Now, that's a phenomenon. That's complete genocide, although it's not on purpose. So I'm not sure you should call it that, but it's a complete population wipeout.
But it's not covered in the textbooks.
Well, you know, I have to say this. My new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me is not only based on my intensive reading of 12 textbooks, but I've now read an additional 6 to bring it up to date. And every chapter has been revised, and all of these textbooks are written after the year 2000. And the biggest single improvement that they make is in the treatment of what we call the Columbian Exchange. And that's this stuff, not only the bringing of diseases across the ocean, and maybe to some degree the opposite direction. It may be that syphilis came to Europe from the Americas. We're not quite sure. But also the bringing of livestock, the bringing of gold and silver from west to east, the bringing of ideas in both directions, ideas like democracy going from west to east, Christianity going from east to west, and so on. Now, the textbooks amazingly completely left out this exchange, whether of disease or gold and silver or livestock or corn and potatoes or whatever, in the first batch of textbooks that I read. In the second batch, these new textbooks, that's the biggest single improvement they make. They now treat it with one exception, and that is they still completely leave out the notion of an exchange of ideas. And that's too bad. That's a shame.
We had talked earlier about foreign interventions. And you write about American history textbooks, quote, see our policies as part of a morality play in which the U.S. typically acts on behalf of human rights, democracy, and the American way, end quote.
Yes.
How does that square with reality?
Well, I think everybody over the age of 8 knows that we don't. It's certainly true that we sometimes try to, but it's also true that often we don't try to, and I'm not even sure that we should try to. That is to say, nations usually try to act in their own self-interest.
Do textbooks, for example, cover the American back coups in Iran in 53 or Guatemala in 54?
Pretty much they do not. There's a couple of individual exceptions that will have a sentence or two about one or another thing. But they do not treat how we stuck the Shah back up on the throne, how we gave chemical weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein and things like that.
How about the role of multinational corporations?
Pretty much not. Again, in Chile, of course, multinationals played a major role, American-based multinationals, in the unseating of the Allende government. And not only did they, but so did our government. Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State at the time, said at one point he didn't see any reason to let Chile go communist, even if its people voted that way. It wasn't going communist, but it was going socialist. It was going kind of the same way Bolivia has recently gone. And so with the permission of the United States, people in Chile killed Allende and replaced him, of course, with an odious dictator who lasted another 20 years and is just one more bad friend the United States had.
Another area that seems that you note that is omitted from textbooks is the question of social class. You say it's really taboo. What does that mean?
Yeah. I've talked with a woman at Scholastic Books, an intelligent, nice person whose, among other claims to fame, is that she has edited more American history textbooks than any other living person. I'm not sure that's what you want to put on your tombstone. but she has. And, excuse me, she said there are three great taboos in American history publishing. And I was able to guess two of them, sex and religion. But I was floored by the third, and the third was social class. And I said, geez, you know, that's about 40% of what we teach in sociology. And I don't mean to be mean about it. It's just a fact that social class influences everything we do. It influences whether you're likely to have hired a lawyer. It influences whether you're likely to have been in the Boy Scouts. It influences all kinds of things. How much TV you watch per week in a negative direction. The higher the social class, the less TV. How long you're going to live. You're going to be buried.
Do they tend to exaggerate the possibility of social mobility?
The textbooks pretty much leave out social class, and they leave it out by not talking about class at all. And when they do talk about class, that's exactly what they do. They say, America, unlike Europe, has very little class system. We're pretty much all middle class, and there's plenty of social mobility. Well, it turns out that that's not true, that in about 1905 or 1910, the United States passed European countries in becoming more stratified, and now we're quite dramatically more stratified than Great Britain, than Japan, than the Scandinavian countries, of course. They are stratified, but we are much more stratified. And that means it's much harder for somebody from the working class to make it into, say, the lower upper class.
In a related matter, you say there's virtually no labor history in the last 50 years covered in the textbooks.
Yeah. Well, in a way, they teach labor history, but without social class, which I think is kind of like teaching the footnotes without the text. I mean, they do. Well, they don't teach any in the last 50 years. I just caught your question. That's right. The last thing they really talk about pretty much is Taft-Hartley back in about 1950 or 54.
So it kind of gives people the idea that a labor union is an anachronism.
That's right. That's right. And that's why we need this book. There's a book published called From the Folks Who Brought You the Weekend that's about labor history. Because many of my students, now University of Vermont, I'm not there anymore, but I taught there for 21 years, and many of my students at the University of Vermont were very rich. It's the most expensive state school, or was for many years, in the U.S., and its out-of-state tuition is even higher, of course. And so rich folks, on the whole, go there. And they not only don't have any sympathy for the working class, they see it as a not just an anachronism, but as a pernicious thing full of corruption and bad political influence that ought to be done away with. They don't really have any idea that the labor movement did bring us the working class. They also didn't have any idea of how badly some people at their very university, like the janitors and the secretaries and so on, were paid. There's tremendous stratification in America still to be dealt with, and the textbooks pretend that we're not stratified.
You say that educators and textbooks seem to want to inculcate the next generation into blind allegiance to our country. Could you expand on that?
Well, that's the evidence even just from the title. I've asked people all across the United States, what was your chemistry textbook called? And they usually don't know, or they say, chemistry. And they're right. It is usually called chemistry, or introduction to chemistry, or principles of chemistry. Even in American literature, you get a title like reader in American literature. Not so in history. You, in history, get titles like Rise of the American Nation, which after we lost the war in Vietnam became retitled Triumph of the American Nation. We get titles like The American Pageant, The Great Republic, and so on. Well, of the six new textbooks, incidentally, every single one of them is red, white, and blue on the cover, and four of them have the American flag on it itself. So I submit to you, they're trying to get you to be nationalist, to salute the flag, while learning about the past. And those two goals are sometimes in conflict. I mean, it's as if kind of your chemistry textbook was called the molecule, but you know it's not. You're just supposed to learn chemistry, but you're not just supposed to learn and think about history. You're also supposed to be becoming a 200% American, a nationalist.
You speculate on why history textbooks are so badly written, and you say, quote, perhaps the adults' biggest reason for lying about American history is that they fear if children were to learn what has really gone on, they would lose all respect for our society.
Well, I don't think that's true. That is, I don't think that our history has been so bad that if we faced it honestly, that would turn off the next generation and they'd run off to Russia or Canada or something like that.
That's the fear is really unfounded.
Yes. I think the problem really is that the people writing the textbooks don't have intellectual integrity. Therefore, the truth is not as important to them as it should be.
Mr. Loewen, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts, and I've been speaking with Jim Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, and I'll be back in a moment.
Are unreachable by these disparate elements in our society.
Well, thanks very much for being with us, Professor Loewen. This is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts, and I've been speaking with Jim Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, and I'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to History Counts. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe. In Lies My Teacher Told Me, Jim Loewen points out that the teaching of American history is sometimes altered according to the prevailing political wind. Take the anti-slavery crusader John Brown, for example. John Brown was hung in 1859 following his unsuccessful effort to incite a slave revolt in the South. In the years immediately following his death, Brown was celebrated as a martyr for the abolition of slavery. However, at the end of Reconstruction in the late 19th century, Brown was depicted in American history textbooks as the crazed victim of mental delusions. Professor Loewen found that Americans are taught a version of history that often leaves out essential facts because they depict U.S. leaders and even the country itself in a poor light. On the other hand, he discovered that history textbooks often ignore American idealism, perhaps out of a fear of its power. For example, Professor Loewen asks why none of the textbooks quote the following statement by Abraham Lincoln in his debates with Stephen Douglas over slavery. "I should like to know," Lincoln asked, "if taking this old Declaration of Independence, which declares that all men are created equal, and making exceptions to it, where will it stop? If one man says it does not mean a Negro, why does not another say it does not mean some other man?" Lincoln summed up the slavery question this way, quote, "It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world." The teaching of history is not just an academic matter. It makes a critical difference as to how well or poorly citizens participate in the government. "Citizens who are their own historians," writes Professor Loewen, "become a formidable force for democracy." So make no mistake about it. History is power. As George Orwell wrote in his novel 1984, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." Thank you for joining us. History Counts is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of this program and others. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.